Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Ken Pollack is with us now, a former Persian Gulf expert for the CIA, the National Security Council, and Vice President Al Gore in the 90s. Pollack became famous for his book advocating the war in Iraq, then famous for expressing his regrets. He is a skeptic about attacks on Syria and has a new book called Unthinkable, Iran, the Bomb, and American Strategy. Ken Pollack, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks very much for having me back, Brian.
And I want to take this opportunity to go down the rest of my list of the top five questions that I tweeted out that are unanswered as far as I'm concerned. And let me start with this one, which I tweeted as question number three. Why does the authorizing resolution allow American boots on the ground when they keep saying it doesn't? What it prohibits is American boots on the ground for combat purposes, but by adding that clause, they precisely keep the door open to American boots on the ground during this mission for whatever they define as something else.
Yeah, and look, I think that this is one of the reasons that I have reservations about what we're doing here, is that I think what you're picking at there, Brian, is a very important little thread of the sweater, which is they don't quite know what they're doing. They don't quite know what it is that they're seeking to achieve. This isn't tied to a larger strategy about Syria, and I, for one, have a lot of concerns that we're going to be able to actually compartmentalize the use of chemical warfare from the larger question of the Syrian civil war and what our interests are there. And so what, in effect, they're saying is, look, we may need to have some guys on the ground, whether it be for special forces guys to do some targeting, whether it be special forces personnel to help CIA in supporting the rebels. It may be some other things that that you and I haven't even thought of yet. But it gets to this point of they're not quite certain what they're doing. And as I said, I get very, very nervous when we talk about limited uses of force in a situation like the Syrian civil war, where actually making something going to happen is probably going to require a lot more than a limited use of force.
And here's the question I tweeted out as question number four, and listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at Brian Lehrer. But why is the authorization for 60 to 90 days when they first told the media that the strikes would only last 1 to 3 days? The Washington Post last week, before the president decided to go to Congress, said 1 to 2 days. NBC News reported that administration officials told them the plan was for 3 days of strikes. Now they're being asked to authorize 60 to 90 days. Can you explain that?
I suspect, and again, you're asking me to interpret it. I'm not telling you whether I endorse it.
Absolutely.
I think that the interpretation is that the administration probably went to them and said, look, you need to give us some flexibility on timing, because even after you authorize it, we're not sure when we would actually fire. We might wait for a target of opportunity. If we get intelligence that says, hey, a month from now, this is going to happen, we might wait for that. In addition, I think that they are thinking about, well, what do the Syrians do? Do they retaliate in some way? Will we need to do follow-on strikes? Will we need to fire a round of cruise missiles and simply examine the damage? And this is a very important thing that you do whenever you do bombing. It's called bomb damage assessment. Did we actually hit what we meant to hit? Do we have to go back in there and hit it again later on? But, again, this is what makes me nervous, is I think it's a very big mistake to assume that we can just do a discrete operation that is only intended to somehow deal with the use of chemical warfare, and that will not further engage us in the wider conflict.
And what people may have seen out there is my tweet number five. What does the McCain amendment to the resolution calling for the action to change the momentum on the battlefield obligate us to do? And here is McCain stating what he got in by voice vote at the last minute.
We need to have that provision that calls for a reversal of momentum on the ground of the battle against Bashar Assad.
Reversal of momentum on the ground, on the battlefield. That's now in the resolution as a stated goal. What does that obligate us to?
Yeah, this is a big one. And I will start by saying that, you know, I have a great deal of respect for John McCain. This is a man who, you know, he has principles, he believes in them, and I think what he is doing here is he actually is trying to force the administration to marry this strike to a larger strategy about Syria. But, of course, John McCain is trying to do that with the strategy for Syria that he approves of, that he wants to see happen, which is a much bigger U.S. involvement in the Syrian civil war. Now, I can defend that involvement. I just wrote a piece for Newsweek last week in which I said, look, there are strong arguments for getting more involved in Syria and a decisive intervention there. There are also strong arguments for staying the heck out. What we're doing is the problem. It's this creeping incremental escalation that really frightens me, because that's Vietnam. And so this is John McCain's solution to that problem, is he's going to try to force the administration to tie this strike to a larger strategy of intervention in Syria, because that's what John McCain favors. I think that that's problematic, very problematic, because first, the administration hasn't actually laid out a strategy to do that. And I think that if that amendment stays there, you know, that could wind up getting the Congress a little bit pregnant on a much, much bigger issue in terms of what is it that we should be doing in Syria, and does the country want to commit itself to helping the opposition, really helping the opposition to win the Syrian civil war, which would mean a much bigger commitment of effort on the part of the United States, probably not ground troops, but a much bigger commitment.
Listeners, we can take some phone calls for Ken Pollack. We have a few minutes with Mr. Pollack, who's a former Persian Gulf expert for the CIA, the National Security Council, and Vice President Gore, and he's the author of the new book, Unthinkable, Iran, the Bomb, and American Strategy. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And since you're focusing primarily on Iran in your work these days, and of course, you know Syria and Iran's linked to Syria, but on Iran, I'm reading conflicting accounts this morning that the new president there, Hassan Rouhani, tweeted a blessed Rosh Hashanah to all Jews, and conversely that Rouhani has no Twitter account. Do you know what's real and what's not on that?
You know, for me, this is absolutely perfect on Iran. And yes, I've got this brand new book out about Iran, and I start the book by saying, look, we have to be really careful about Iran because it's this unbelievably confusing place. What we think we know often turns out to be absolutely incorrect. My understanding is that the Twitter account is valid. And, you know, it doesn't really surprise me that Hassan Rouhani would actually tweet Rosh Hashanah greetings to Jews of the world. That is very consistent with the message that he's trying to put out there, that, look, I want reconciliation. I'm a reasonable man. I want to move Iran in a new direction. So even if it somehow turns out to be bogus, I nevertheless do think that it is consistent with this message that he's putting out. I think we need to focus past, you know, whether this was a real tweet or not, and actually focus on the question of, can we get a deal with the Iranians? Are they willing to make one? And, you know, there the bigger issue is Rouhani really does seem to want a better relationship. But there are some really big question marks. I mean, first, we don't quite know what he's willing to agree to. I mean, it's one thing to say, I want a better relationship with you. I'm willing to talk to you about our nuclear program. It's another thing to actually agree to do what we want them to do with their nuclear program. And the second thing, and in some ways the even bigger thing, is let's assume for a moment that Hassan Rouhani actually wants to do what we want him to do, which would be terrific. At the end of the day, he's not the ultimate decision maker in Iran. The ultimate decision maker is the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and Ayatollah Khamenei is deeply suspicious of the United States. He considers us his enemy. He has been the guy who's been blocking the deal. So even if Rouhani wants to do the deal, he may not be able to.
And one of the reasons you're skeptical of U.S. military action in Syria is that it's a bad idea to go to war with one country to impress another. But conventional media analysis has Iran deciding the U.S. is weak-willed on going to war in the region at all to stop WMDs if we don't do this, and therefore Iran is more likely to push its nuclear weapons program to completion if Obama fails to follow through on his red line. Do you not buy that?
I think that we are reading way too much into that. I mean, first, you're absolutely right. My feeling is you don't go to war with one country to impress another. That's how we've gotten into some of our worst wars. I mean, that was part of the rationale for Korea. That was part of the rationale for Vietnam. You know, neither of those are experiences that I think that we want to repeat. With regard to the Iranians, and again, it's something I talk about a lot in the book, you know, what we've consistently found about the Iranians is, you know, they're not crazy, they're not irrational, but they do not think the way that we do, and they don't see the world the way that we do. And to start making these assumptions about what Iran is going to take away from the Syria crisis, I think is a very big mistake. It has gotten us into lots of trouble in the past. I mean, I'll just make one point about that. One of the things we do know about the Iranians in Syria is the Iranians think that they are way more important and way more powerful than Syria. And so as a result, they aren't really measuring anything that the U.S. does to Syria as somehow being relevant to them because they think they're so much more important. And I imagine that you could have Iranians making the argument in both directions. You could have some Iranians saying, well, you know, look, they were willing to bomb Syria because Syria is nothing. Who cares? But, you know, we are much more important, more powerful. They'd never dare to do it to us. Or others saying, well, they didn't bomb Syria if we don't wind up bombing Syria. But, you know, that's because they didn't really care about Syria. But we matter. We're Iran. We're important. They would bomb us. You know, this is what we found time and again, Brian, is that we think that Iran is going to work in a certain way. We think that they think like we do. And then when we actually go back and find out what they were actually thinking, it turns out it was completely different. Mm.
Larry in Bayside, you're on WNYC with Ken Pollack. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Ken. I think your analogy with Vietnam really breaks down. I don't think we're in a position where we have a president who believes he's stopping worldwide communism and a domino effect. I think that the president is actually being pushed into defending the International Convention Against Chemical Weapons. And if we can't do this as a military power, as the last superpower, we don't really have credibility in the world anymore. I don't think that the administration wants to do this. I think the military is overtaxed. We have people on their fourth and fifth deployments. I don't think the resolution is really designed to put slowly more and more ground troops in. I think air operations will probably be necessary. I think we'll be staging out of Turkey, and aircraft carriers will need laser designators on the ground and forward air traffic controllers in order to hit specific targets. And we may move toward defeating his air force or making sure that we have effectively a no-fly zone. But I don't think that the administration wants to go any further into this than they have to. He's winding down our, you know, this is a country that's moving toward isolationism and passivism at this point. This is an unpopular move. 80% of the American people are not looking forward to this. I think he's literally trying to uphold the international conventions and considerations that were born in World War I when hundreds of thousands of men came home with half a lung and told horror stories about these kinds of weapons. This is something that we need to do morally, and it's his Rwanda moment. And he doesn't want to do this, but I don't think he has a choice. And when he turned around and had no political support, he turned to the Congress and said, okay, you want to snipe if I do nothing and snipe if I do something, you're on board too. And this is the ultimate. We're going to show the world that this is a democracy. Mm-hmm. And we're going to either go here, not go to war, but stand up and use our military power to prevent another tragedy.
Larry, thank you very much for your call. And as our time is starting to run short with Ken Pollack, he said a lot. Let me pull the chemical weapons treaty out of that and the experience going all the way back to World War I and the imperative, as he sees it, as the president apparently sees it, as John Kerry certainly sees it, of upholding this chemical weapons treaty because it just matters. It's the human rights thing to do. It's the anti-war criminal thing to do, and that sets a precedent for the future everywhere.
Yeah. First, Brian, let me say, I couldn't appreciate more your very eloquent and thoughtful remarks I think it's actually one of the good things that's happened is that we're having a very smart debate about this for the first time, and it's one I think we should have had in the past. But I do want to pick up on Brian's question and marry that up with some of the points that Larry made, because this is what concerns me, is that, first, we have seen uses of chemical warfare in the past. We've not done anything about them. We shouldn't forget Saddam Hussein killed thousands, probably tens of thousands, of his own people with chemical warfare. We, of course, did nothing.
At that time, he was sort of our ally before he was our enemy, right?
And by the way, it also did not lead to more uses of chemical warfare. Let's also remember that. Second, again, I can make the case in favor of doing this. What I can't make the case in favor of doing is that this is somehow going to be compartmentalized and kept discreet from our larger Syria policy. And I think in Larry's very smart remarks, you saw exactly that, that the chances are that this is going to lead to a no-fly zone. Okay, and the problem is that the no-fly zone isn't going to have any impact because the Syrian Air Force is really not what's doing the job in Syria. It's not doing the killing. I think that it is going to lead to airstrikes against ground forces. And I will put it this way. Whether we strike Assad or not, I think it is highly likely he will use chemical warfare again. If we strike him, I think it will be some time. I don't think he'll do it immediately. I think it will deter him for a while. But when his regime starts to collapse, which of course is our policy in Syria, I believe that he will use those chemical warfare agents again to stave off his defeat. And when that happens, we're going to have to do more than we did this time around. That's going to get us more involved. That's why the debate that I want to have now, that we need to have now, is over what is it that we're doing in Syria and what is the best way to go about doing that. And I think the mistake the president is making is thinking he can keep these issues discreet.
One more call. Juliet in Hoboken, you're on WNYC with Ken Pollack. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
You know, I agree morally we should go in, but I am concerned about the jihadists involved in this uprising. You know, they have their fingers in a lot of uprisings, you know, in that region, and they just, you know, it makes me nervous that we are possibly assisting them, you know, in their agitation. You know, that's what they're doing. They like to get in and agitate, and, you know, it makes me nervous that we'd be on the same side with them, and then the after effects, who knows, but, you know, we don't know who this resistance is, but we do need to help these people. They need our help, but it's very confusing.
Juliet, thank you. And, you know, we went to war in Iraq in part so that Saddam Hussein couldn't potentially, maybe someday, maybe he might have a relationship with al-Qaeda. We're going potentially to war in Syria knowing that the side we're intervening on the side of does have a relationship with al-Qaeda. Can the so-called moderate rebels be separated by U.S. intervention from the al-Qaeda-linked rebels? Juliet, I think, stated well how complicated it is.
Yeah, I agree. And again, I think it's a great question, Juliet. And I would say, you know, can it be done? Sure, potentially. It would be very hard, and it is highly, highly unlikely that that could happen through the kind of limited intervention that we're currently contemplating, whether it be the cruise missile strikes or the kind of very limited arms and small unit training that we're providing to the Syrian opposition. And there are two real ways to think about dealing with the jihadist problem in Syria. First, there is the strategy that typically gets associated with Joe Biden in Afghanistan, which is we stay out, we stay away from the place, and we simply go after targets of opportunity and wage a counter-terror war in Syria, really the way that we have been doing in Yemen, with some degree of success there. And if you don't want to go into Syria at all, I think that's how you think about the jihadist, the terrorist problem in Syria. The alternative is actually how we handled the wars in Libya, in Bosnia, and Kosovo. And remember, I worked for President, I was at the Clinton White House, I was in the NSC under President Clinton. Yep. I remember Bosnia, I remember Kosovo. We had the same problems there. Both al-Qaeda and Hezbollah were in Kosovo, were in Bosnia, trying to help the very same people we were trying to help. And in both of those cases, and in Libya as well, what we did was we went to the opposition and we said to them, you've got a choice to make. You can either get in bed with al-Qaeda and and Hezbollah, or with us, not both. And in every one of those cases, they chose us. And I think that the same thing, it's going to be harder now in Syria, but I think that the same thing is true in Syria. If we were willing to make a Bosnia-style commitment, where we made a major effort to build a Syrian army, maybe provided it with air power, I think that there is a very reasonable expectation that we could get the jihadist problem under control. I mean, that actually is much more along the lines of what happened eventually in Iraq. Okay. But absent that kind of commitment, no way.
Ken Pollack's new book is Unthinkable, Iran, the Bomb, and American Strategy. Thank you so much for giving us this time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me back, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the summer after Sandy, we'll check in on business and the recovery business as Labor Day weekends and the summer tourist season ends, from the Jersey Shore to Fire Island. And then Lydia Callis, you know who she is? The one who became famous during Sandy as Mayor Bloomberg's sign language interpreter. She'll talk about her audience, things you don't know about the hearing impaired in New York, and what policies they need from the city. Stay with us.